So, you know, there's a lot of passages in the Bible that really create an emotional, powerful response. Daniel has quite a few of them. I really like the dream. This event with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego is probably one of the most exciting events in the Old Testament because of its grandeur. I mean, we'll be talking about that this evening. But it's just to see God's people being crushed down and have God just reach in and pull them right out of the fiery furnace is just a... And we just have to make that application, because it's like they said, he can deliver us from your hand, and he will deliver us, but what? If we still have to die, that's all right. It's all right. And of course, that's how Paul looked at it, and that's how all God's people look at it. So, but there's an underlying current that or theme that I want to kind of start developing now, and that is Nebuchadnezzar. Would you say he is in our most likely to succeed or least likely to succeed category?
Right now he's least, but he gets...
Okay, so he's just conquered Jerusalem and destroyed the temple, and he's taken these people captive. So what's his view of God at this point? See, he doesn't see God as very powerful. So God begins to work on the man, because we know where it's going to end. It ends with him actually making a good confession, not the good confession, because Christ hasn't come yet, but he makes the confession that God is God, and that he is king, ruler of kings and most high in heaven. And so what starts the process, I think, is when the three young men or four young men are brought in before him. And what does it tell us about their wisdom compared to all the rest of the wise men?
They were 10 times better.
You find that in here, you already know it. Okay. If you kind of scan the notes, you might have the answers here, right? All right, so Nebuchadnezzar has interviewed these young boys, and he has found them to be better than everyone else in the kingdom, including all of his wise men. Now, should that tell him something? Does it? No. No, it doesn't. So then he has a dream, and Daniel comes in, and Daniel gives him the dream and the interpretation. And this is the second thing that God does in this process of bringing Nebuchadnezzar around. But it doesn't really do much good either, as we'll see this evening. So let's go ahead and pick up then. And Nebuchadnezzar is overwhelmed. And that is that he falls down on his face. Now, do kings usually do that?
Definitely not.
Fall down on their face in front of someone. And it appears that he's worshiping him. It says he fell on his face, prostrate before Daniel, and commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him. Now, what does that kind of sound like? An offering and incense to Daniel. Now, has Daniel made it clear? Got nothing to do with me?
Yep.
Yeah, he's already made that clear. But can Nebuchadnezzar hear things like that? I mean, in his worldview and in his mindset, can he even comprehend the idea that the man who does the work is not connected with the God and should have the same honor and glory? So, but then he does make an interesting confession. It says in verse 47, "Your God truly is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and a revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret." Is that a confession? You know, you might be inclined to think so, but what happens when he finds out that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego will not bow down to his gods? Does he say, well, you're servants of the Most High God, so we'll just let it go? No, he's not there yet, is he? He's not there yet. He has been brought to an understanding, but as I say in that middle paragraph there, he's still in the early stages of the process of conversion. It will take several more events. The fiery furnace, the dream that warned him, and the curse that humbled him. So it actually takes 5 things to get Nebuchadnezzar to come around, which is pretty good, because how many other people ever come around? I mean, a lot of people have been given opportunities to become servants of God and seen some amazing things. Think about the children of Israel. How many things did God give them to turn them around? And did they ever come around? So Nebuchadnezzar, he must have a pretty good heart, because God works with him and brings him around. And again, I mean, none of us know whether he was saved or not, but the implications look pretty good. So we'll have to see. George?
Isn't there something in Isaiah or somewhere?
prophet, it's Ian that tells us why God replaced Nebuchadnezzar, because he was not doing right in the sight of God.
It wouldn't be Isaiah. Ezekiel, maybe. If it's anyone.
Yeah, that's not coming to me at all, George. He dies, his son takes over, and then the kingdom is taken from his son. So I'm not sure. I can't. Go ahead.
And I don't remember, but when we were studying the minor prophets, there the one that questions God, "Oh Lord, you know, how long are you gonna
Habakkuk
to Israelites?"
Yeah, Habakkuk.
And God says, "Oh, I'm raising up the Babylonians equivalent to take care of them." And then he says, "The Babylonians, they're terrible." And he says, "Yeah, well, I'll come around and judge them too."
Right. Yeah. And of course he does. I mean, Nebuchadnezzar's dead, but as soon as the son becomes king, remember he praises the gods of gold with the articles from God's temple, and we get the handwriting on the wall. And then that very night he dies and the kingdom goes to the Medes and the Persians. So, yeah, I'll have to think about that, George. I'm not sure where that is. Johnny?
Here's a comparison with Nebuchadnezzar and Pharaoh of Egypt. When he let the children go, he didn't believe in the God before or after.
Right.
He was supreme, and nobody was better than him.
Yeah. Well, and it's like Jesus said twice to the Jews. He said there were many lepers in Israel, but who did God send Elijah to heal?
Naaman
the Syrian. And there were many widows in Israel, but he sent Elijah to a widow who was not in Israel. So is God working with people who are not in Israel?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, he is. And, yeah, I don't know what we can say about Nebuchadnezzar, except he did end his life glorifying God, and this process went through. And so we get a chance to look at how God works with people, how God makes people go into favor with people, how God uses events to bring things about. And it's just more and more crystallizing in my mind the idea that if we want God's providence to be working for us and not against us, what had we better do? We had better be faithful. And the more faithful we are, the more expectations of God's providential working in our lives we can expect. And the less faithful we are, the more chance there is that we're going to be used as a vessel of wrath instead of a vessel of mercy. All right, so God has now brought Daniel to the forefront. Not only let's face it, would it have been headlines that all the wise men of Babylon are going to be put to death? Would that be pretty common? Would it be kind of interesting to figure out why didn't he do it? And why didn't he do it? Because Daniel was able to interpret it. And who becomes the ruler over the entire province? Daniel. And who's Daniel's God? Well, he's the God who could. So are we dealing with evangelistic activities here? Are we dealing with opportunities for people to see the truth? And so God is working, and God is bringing these things about. And again, it isn't just for Daniel, and it isn't just for Nebuchadnezzar. God is working his plan, and he's going to use Nebuchadnezzar to teach the people that God rules in the kingdoms of men and gives it to whoever he wishes. So right there again in the middle of the page, he does three things for Daniel. He makes him ruler over the whole province of Babylon. He makes him the chief administrator over all the wise men. Now, what's the difference between being a ruler over the province and being an administrator over the wise men? One's a general thing, right?
Governor.
I mean, you're ruler, you're governor over the entire province, over the entire province of Babylon. But you're also, and this must have stuck in the craw of some of them, but who's now running the whole show?
Daniel.
And then the third thing, he's sitting in the gate or the court of the king. And then the final point in that chapter is, what does Daniel decide to do with his three friends? Okay, he wants them. Are they part of this? I mean, were they with him when they prayed to God and God gave them the revelation? As far as Daniel is concerned, we're all equal.
And so when he gets this benefit, he wants to share it with his three friends. And the importance of this, though, is that does the king know Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Yeah, see, he's been brought to their attention. Or excuse me, Daniel has gone into him. He has petitioned the king, and he has put him, I guess you'd say, right under him, wouldn't you? I mean, Daniel is running the show, but it says he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. So, do you think the king knows who they are? Yeah, he knows who they are. And it's interesting, and we'll see this, because when they're brought before him, he gives them a chance. I mean, he's already made it to, well, I don't want to get too far ahead. So let's stay with the text. All right, his image of gold. Everybody wants to know, what does it look like? And the only answer we give, I spent some time on it this afternoon, and the Aramaic term is only used in Daniel 2 and 3. It's never used anywhere else in the scriptures, so we don't really have any point of comparison because it's not a Hebrew word, it's an Aramaic word. And they didn't start speaking Aramaic until they went to Babylon, which is where they learned Aramaic. Prior to that, they were always speaking Hebrew. So this is one of the first uses of this term. And it's used in two different contexts. The first one, as you see there on the bottom of page 2, that the image the king saw in his dream was this word. Now, what was the image he saw in his dream? Well, it had a head of gold, and it had arms, and it had feet, and it had legs. And so what was it?
Human.
It was a human. And then the other use of the term is at the very bottom of page 1, and that is when Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury, the expression on his face changed towards Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So the term expression on the face is the same word as this image. So most people are fairly confident that this is an image of a man. The problem they run into is it's only 9 feet wide and 90 feet tall. And how would you get that to look like a man? You know, most of us, I think of a pillar, a 9 foot around and then 90 feet tall. But, you know, I took some time this afternoon and got a bunch of images and then left them on my computer. But some people have it looking like a pillar until the last maybe 30 feet, and then they have the image of a man. Others put him on a pedestal, so the pedestal is up 25, 30 feet. Then you have the image of a man. But the idea, and then, of course, people say, well, what did it look like? Some people say, well, it was an image of Nebuchadnezzar. Other people say, no, it was his father. And, you're looking at this stuff, and you're going, well,
I don't know.
We don't know. Yeah, that's probably the best way of looking at it. We just don't know. So, but why, if Nebuchadnezzar had been influenced by Daniel, why would he make this idol and demand everybody bow down to it? What does that tell you about his conversion to the Most High God? Okay, it was not very deep. But there is one interesting thing. Everybody is commanded to come, but who's not there?
Daniel.
Now, why isn't Daniel there?
Who would want to be there?
Well, what is Nebuchadnezzar? I mean, Nebuchadnezzar's got to know. What's going to happen if he brings Daniel?
He'll be upset.
Well, he's not going to do it, right? He's not going to bow down to that image. So what will that force Nebuchadnezzar to do?
Kill him.
So put him to death. So he's exempt. Now, that's one possibility. Of course, you could make the other possibility. Well, he was out on a job and he just couldn't come. But it's pretty clear in verse 2 that he sent word to gather together the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the province to come to the dedication. Does that leave anybody out? Well, but Daniel's not there. So maybe he has some growth, maybe not. George?
How do we really know he wasn't there, or that the people that brought Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to Nebuchadnezzar's view, if you will, were noting them specifically for some reason, because they had been left out of being part of the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar?
Well, the only inference would be in verse 4. The herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that at the time you hear," and then I'm not going to go through that, but it says, "Whoever does not fall down and worship shall be what? Cast immediately." So he either wasn't there, or there was some special provisions given to him, which would somewhat lessen the power of the king's command. So, you know, you're right, George. I mean, I guess you couldn't say for sure he wasn't there, but I think the conclusion, at least for me, it's fairly necessary, is that why would you want to bring somebody there that you knew wasn't going to want to keep your command?
Well, that might be true, too, but there's no real indication of it. But how many people were in this throng of people anyway for someone to keep an eye on? Is one thing that occurs to me. So, Daniel was not with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, but was in the crowd. He might have got left out for some reason, too.
Well, I can't argue with that. That's just as good a possibility as mine. So, anyway, he was there, and he didn't. Either way, what didn't Daniel do? He didn't bow down to the idol, and he didn't get thrown in the fiery furnace. Carl?
Yeah, I got a question. Jeff sent me a question they asked, where was Daniel when the Hebrew brethren got tossed into the fiery furnace? The first thing I want to know, what difference does it make? But I couldn't answer that, so I just said, the scripture doesn't tell us.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Okay, Johnny?
I have a wondering in my mind. All these characters in Scripture, going back to these golden images, where in the world did they find all this gold that they're talking about?
Well, Nebuchadnezzar just conquered about how many million places and took all their gold. I don't know how much. There might have been enough gold in the temple to...
Somebody had to have gold to begin with.
What
did they get?
Oh, well...
Refine it.
Temple had a lot of gold.
I think Job deals with that. Talks about how they took mountains up by the roots, and talks about taking lanterns and going under the earth and stopping up streams so they can go in and get all the gold. So they were just as ingenious as we are. Said exact opposite word there. All right. So yeah, I don't know. There was plenty of gold.
God gave them knowledge.
What's that? Well, yeah, they were made in the image and likeness of God, so they worked it out. Jason?
Solomon's trading brought a lot of gold into the kingdom.
That's true. That's true. And what Assyria didn't take, Nebuchadnezzar got it back from Assyria. So all the gold in the world was coming into at this time. I think somebody figured it out. It would take 1,000 talents of gold to make this image. If you add it up, and I think there was that much in Jerusalem at one point, 1,000 talents was not a lot of money. All right, so we don't know if Daniel was there or not, and we don't know what the image looked like, but we do know this. Nebuchadnezzar has made a decree that you must bow down to this image. Now, you look at all these musical instruments. And I just look at it like an orchestra. If you go into an orchestra, do you see a lot of different instruments?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, is it impressive to see that many instruments in one place? No, it's pretty normal. This is probably something that they did often. We're just not accustomed to thinking about adding them all up. I mean, if you were to sit down and write down all the instruments in an orchestra and say, when you come here today, you're going to hear that, what would you be saying? It's kind of overwhelming. So, sounds like a lot, but really what we have here, and I suspect it was a song. I doubt if they were just blowing, making noise. This was something that Nebuchadnezzar had either dedicated for the occasion or had laid it out in such a way, or they'd always done that. You think it was just a bunch of noise? Does that make sense to you? No, it's probably a very beautiful song. And then he throws in the charge. If you do not worship, okay, where were we? Okay, there it is. Yeah, on the middle of page 2. Let's go ahead and start reading some of this. Well, actually, at this point, I just want to read verse 6 because I don't like to have to read through all those different instruments over and over again. So in verse 6, it says, whoever does not fall down and worship shall be what? Okay, so he is making this a death penalty offense. Which again, if he had any real belief that Daniel's God was God of gods, why would he do this? So his conviction was just emotional and very short-lived because he makes it a death penalty offense if nobody... Now, why can't Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego just go ahead and bow down? And why couldn't the Christians in the first century just say, well, we don't have any physical king but Caesar. Why couldn't they do that?
I'm a jealous God. I should make no graven image.
Okay, and that's right. That's right there. It's one of the, what is the third commandment? Second commandment? Mm-hmm. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make any graven images, nor shall you bow down to them. So there was, and as Tim pointed out, God is a jealous God. So there was no way for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to compromise at all. And that's one of the things that I really appreciate about this situation. And that is, when you initially start out doing something and you're already committed and convicted and you never compromise, when something like this happens, what's your immediate response?
It's not even a question.
Yeah, there's no question. But if you've been compromising along the way, mm-hmm. What happens when this comes along?
Compromise a little bit more.
So, and this all started when these young people, remember, I don't know how old they were. They were probably under 20 when they're brought into Nebuchadnezzar's court. And the first thing that they're told to do is drink this wine and eat this food. And what does Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and Daniel decide they're going to do? We're not going to compromise. We are not going to eat this food. Well, God blesses them and gives them the opportunity. But then as time goes on, these four men are absolutely committed. Inside and out, in every situation, under all circumstances, when that is your mode of life and a problem comes along, what's your first response? Can't be done. But if you've been kind of wishy-washy and compromising all the way through, when this kind of situation comes up, what are you going to do?
Break.
See, then you do it a little differently. And so I think this is very important for us to think about in our own personal lives if you were ever put into this kind of a situation, whether we're compromising now and if we, you know, it's like that frog in the hot water. You know, as it gets hotter and hotter, what does the frog do? He doesn't do anything. And sometimes that's what Christians are doing. They make a compromise, it gets a little tougher, they make another compromise, it gets a little tougher, and pretty soon they are in a situation where it's serve God or die, and they're not going to serve God. And so this, the psychology here, or the spirituality here, is I think very important for all of us to look at in our own personal lives, because these guys didn't have any idea this was coming, and they didn't have a whole lot of time to prepare for it. So when they are drug in front of the king, is there any deliberating they have to do? See, this decision was made long ago. And this is something that, again, all Christians need to give careful thought to, because sometimes you get put into those kind of situations where you just say, no, I'm not going to do it. I don't care what the consequences are. This is not something I'm going to do. But it's not something you can't make the decision right then. That decision already has to have been made. Jeff?
Well, and in the particular case, since it was public, you imagine the peer pressure. You know, everyone else is doing their thing, and you're sticking out.
Right. Yeah. Okay. No, that's right.
Like a sore thumb.
Then there's the other peer pressure we talked about. You weren't here in the class, but I made a kind of a pun, which is the peer pressure for the Christian is what? Is God. God and God's people. So they have a peer pressure that's stronger for them than the other peer pressure. So, and that's how we have to look at it. Because, as I say, God's with us everywhere, and man's with us everywhere. Who are we going to disappoint? God or man?
You got to make a choice, right? It's not like, oh, all these people are looking at me. Well, so is God. You're in the sight of God too. You got pressure. Yeah, you got pressure coming from God. You got pressure coming from these people. If you have enough faith, which pressure is going to always win? So, you're right, Jeff. I mean, he's got all the leaders of all the provinces are there. Carl.
Yeah. See, the king once he issued the command, he came back down. Same thing happened to Herod and John the Baptist.
Right.
See, he promised that girl Salome that anything she wished asked for, he would give it.
Right.
He was the king, and all his princes around him, and his political people, and his, that.
Yep. There's that peer pressure. Yeah.
And man died off his word, you know. So yeah. It cost John the Baptist his head.
That's true, Charles.
Yeah, also along the same lines, too. You know, we're mindful of lukewarm Christians. You know, if we're that lukewarm individual right there, you know, where we kind of halfway this way and halfway that way, you know, God will spit us out of his mouth.
Yeah.
You know? So we have to, it's something that you have to make up your mind about. You know, what are you going to do? You're going to be on the Lord's side, or you're going to be on the man's side?
Right. Well, we got that song too. Yield not yield not to temptation, for yielding is sin. Each victory will help you.
Some other to win.
And these guys were tempted. As I said, they didn't have any parents around. No older people were around. They could have very easily just said, "Well, there's nothing we can do about it. We're just going to fit in." But they didn't. They stood up. And again, these are the kind of things that we need to be monitoring in our own life, because when we see ourselves just easily succumbing to temptation, when that big one comes that means eternity one way or another, we're not going to be prepared to make the right decision. All right. So Nebuchadnezzar. Well, okay. The event occurs. Everybody bows down. And then right after it happens, here comes some Chaldeans up to Nebuchadnezzar to tell him what?
Who's not bowing down to you?
Yeah, these three guys are not bowing down to you. Now, what had God decreed? What did he already decree? Hang on one second, Johnny. What did he already decree? If anyone doesn't do this, he will be immediately. But what does he do to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego?
He gives them a second chance.
Now, that's going to be very important. And there's another thing we're going to see in just a moment. But Johnny, go ahead.
To begin with, this was seen as putting these wise men near the four men. I can't get my words out.
That's all right. Take a breath and start over.
They set up a scam for the four men to be punished, because evidently they were so, the king Nebuchadnezzar was so enthralled with those four men. I'm sorry, I can't say what I was talking.
Okay, well, if you get it in a minute, raise your hand again. All right?
Maybe.
Okay. Now, it says on the very bottom of page 2, what was the emotion that he initially felt?
Rage and fury.
Rage and fury. So then the command is given to bring them to him. And then when he gets there, let's go ahead and turn to page 3. Okay, what's the question there at the top of the page?
Is it true?
In spite of his rage, he has a respect for these men. Matter of fact, it isn't until their answer. If you drop down to the very bottom of page 3, the expression on his face changed. So what was the expression on his face? Now remember, this is the word image again. What was the expression on his face before they answered him like this?
Rage and fury.
No, it was rage and fury after. So what was it before?
Concern or questioning.
Okay.
Or
he knew who they were, and he knew who they served, and he was concerned. Otherwise, I mean, as I say, normally when a king says, if you don't bow down, you're going to be thrown immediately in the fiery furnace, and they say, well, these three guys didn't bow down, what do you expect the next statement to be? Throw him in the furnace. No, bring him here. And in his rage and fury, he says, is it true? and now here's your chance. We're going to do this again. You're going to have a chance to bow down. So is he giving these guys special favor?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So as I say, it didn't. Whatever happened with Daniel did not completely change him from an idolater into a servant of God, but it left him with enough concern that, you know, he knew he was in a tough situation here. Like somebody said, I mean, it was Carl said with Herod. Now I can't back down here. So, but their answer, their answer is interesting, isn't it? So in let's look at that right in the middle of page 3. It says, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this is the case, in other words, if you're putting us into the situation of worshiping your idol or dying, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. Bold?
Very.
Have they been with Jesus? Remember that statement about the apostles? That they perceived they had been with Jesus? These men were committed, convicted servants of God, and no amount of peer pressure. And again, once you trust God and you believe God and you're convicted to serve God, what's peer pressure? See, it doesn't mean anything because the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? And that's the response of truly devout people. And again, this isn't something that you just switch on overnight. This is something you grow into. This is something you make a decision. You make another decision. You make another decision. You build this armor. You build this commitment and this character. Then when you get put into this kind of a situation, will God allow people to be put in a position where they can't bear it? So does God know these men can handle this?
Yes.
Yeah. So there's not a question about it. And so their commitment, and again, this is where the hairs on the back of my neck go up, because I just think to myself, these guys are amazing. I really respect them, and I appreciate them, and I can relate to them. I mean, I know exactly how they felt. Because over the years, after reading all these different Bible characters, you just develop an affinity for these. These are our fathers. These are our brothers. These are people that again, they're our peers. These are the people that need to be influencing us, not these ungodly people in the world. We don't have any affinity with them. We don't have anything in common with them. They shouldn't. They're what we think about them or what they think about us shouldn't have any real indication or application at all. But there's another underlying theme here is, and that is, how many people are watching this event now?
Everybody.
And is everybody pretty intent?
Yeah.
And here's what happened. Look at these 6 points in that little box on page 3. Since it was all done in the same hour, everyone gathered for the initial event is now witnessing the execution. All right? The anticipation is going to be heightened. How long do you think it takes to get a furnace 7 times hotter than normal? So they're watching, you know, the king's just furious, and they're building this up. And then the 3 men are tied up, and as they're being brought to the furnace, some of his best, well-known hero, mighty men of valor, carry them up there. And as they get near the furnace, what happens to them? They all die. Okay, so can you see how this is building? Can you imagine how this would be reported on the morning news as rumors went about this? However, news they had back then. The heat of the fire kills them all. Every eye is glued on that furnace as those guys tumble in there. Now, very unlikely that everybody could see inside of the furnace, but could everybody see the king? And did they see his response?
Yeah.
He runs up to the furnace and he calls and he says, come on out, come out. And they hear him say the things that are said here. King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, it says in verse 24. He rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, did we not cast 3 men bound into the midst of the fire? They answered and said, true, O king. Look, he answered, I see 4 men loose walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. Now, another interesting question. Who was that fourth person?
We don't know.
We don't know.
The question is, how do you recognize him as the Son of God?
Well, later he says an angel. Toward the end he says an angel. I think he was just saying there's something so spectacular about this fourth person that he's not human.
Or the Holy Spirit had a role in that.
Well, yeah. And, of course, is this a vision? Are they seeing a vision, this fourth person in there? Is that when you see spiritual things, is that a vision?
No, this is real.
This is real.
Well, but aren't visions real?
We don't know, right?
Define real.
Well, okay, let me... I think we dealt with this just a couple of weeks ago. When Peter, James, and John went up onto the mountain and they saw Jesus transfigured, Jesus told them, don't tell anyone about this vision.
Oh, okay.
So was it a vision or was it real?
Both. Yes.
Both? Yeah. So that's why I'm saying... the conclusion I drew after looking at all those points is that visions are simply God's way of allowing us to see spiritual things. Because do we have eyes to see spiritual things? Could we see God with our physical eyes? No, he'd have to give us some means of being able to see him. And so that's why it's called a vision. But yeah, no, it's real. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying if there was a fourth being in there that was a spiritual being, then it was a vision that they were seeing. And yes, visions are real. You remember what Peter said when he was broken out of Herod's prison? He said he thought he saw a vision. So the reality of a vision versus real. And Paul says the same thing. I went up into the third heaven and saw things that are unlawful for a man to, because of the exceeding greatness of the visions, a thorn in the flesh was given to me. So God seems to equate the looking at spiritual things, even though they're real, with a vision. George?
Are you saying then that Abraham was only having a vision when God was telling him about Sodom and Gomorrah and about that Isaac would be born? Because those evidently were at least angels of God who came, not God himself.
Well, yeah, so it'd have to be a vision. I mean, he was talking to God. But God in the form of a man. Is God in the form of a man, or was he seeing a vision? I don't know how to answer that question, George.
Well, I've just never heard that situation called a vision. That's why I ask.
Well, all right. I'm drawing from stuff we kind of laid out in the previous class. So anyway, let's just move on. Is that the second bell? All right, well, it all worked out well, and next week we'll start in the next chapter. So actually, we'll spend a little bit more time on this next week. But yeah, do some study on that. I mean, like I said, I had a handout. I can't remember what book it was in. I think it was last week's Daniel class. And we had like two or three pages where we went through all the visions and dreams, and we talked about the difference between visions and dreams and how all the spiritual interactions between God and man were often depicted as visions and dreams. And then the conclusion that I drew is that we can't see with the physical eye, so any contact that we have in the spiritual realm has got to be by God opening up a vista, showing us something that we couldn't normally see, and the name for that is vision. So that's all. That's the only reason that I ended it that way. All right, we'll go ahead and stop there. And like I say, we'll talk a little bit more about the end of this event in our class next week, and then move into his dream. Thank you.